Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Welcome to Screen Talk, everybody. I'm Ann Thompson, joined by Ryan Latanzio. And the award season has taken off in a big way because the New York Film Critics and the Gotham Awards have been announced. And it's there's some patterns emerging. There's some movies that are actually getting multiple attention. I would argue, and you can argue with me if you like, Ryan, I would argue that the New York Film Critics have a lot more impact on the Oscar race than the Gothams do. But I would also argue that said, the critics are hardly predictive of anything that's going to actually happen at the Oscars. We can kind of go through it and see what you think is actually going to repeat. What do you think, Ryan? What is your takeaway from these two awards groups?
Well, you are right about that in the sense that the Gothams are these more kind of obscure committees that are assigned to each category that choose the awards. And of course, this year they lifted the eligibility cap. So, you know, it used to be that only films that were $35 million or less, and this has kept going up over the years, would be eligible for Gothams, right? But now that cap is no longer there. But I felt like the Gothams still did. The winners overall reflected an independent spirit for the most part. I mean, I did attend that event and, you know, I had a great time. I sat at a table and I watched the awards and I was there for this Robert De Niro moment that kind of went viral where his speech was allegedly censored on the teleprompter. And it was a speech that was meant to be very damning of President Trump, as it often is. And so it was kind of, I don't want to say it was a boring award ceremony, but it did follow this sort of typical pattern. And then this sort of crazy thing happened that sort of brought everyone into a tizzy.
But the Gothams are not, they're barely online. I mean, they're the most bare bones award show. It's not like anyone watches it.
No. I think at one point the numbers for the stream on YouTube, it was like 5,000 viewers or something.
Unbelievable. You know, I know. It's like, yeah. We get more people on IndieWire in 5 minutes, you know.
That's right.
The point is that somehow if a pattern starts to emerge, like, for example, I can say that Netflix must be happy that Todd Haynes, May December, is, you know, Charles Melton won Best Supporting Actor from the Gothams and the New York Film Critics. So that's really remarkable. That's a sign of strength that could make a difference where people consider him differently. And he gets more credibility, if you like, going forward.
But I feel like you don't necessarily agree with this choice about Charles Melton being the best supporting actor.
I'm a little befuddled by this, actually. I am. I don't get it. I wasn't impressed to the same degree. I'm wondering if I'm wrong. I'm wondering what I missed. You know, but May December is one of those movies where I'm often wonder, you know, I like one part of it, the part that has to do with the acting, you know, the Natalie Portman, Julianne Moore imitation, that whole thing and how she behaves, how Natalie Portman behaves and lures the guy played by Charles Melton, the husband, into, trying to seduce him. This is all fascinating to me, but there's a lot of other stuff going on in the movie that I don't think Todd Haynes fully pulls out, in a good way.
Now that I've published a lot of my pieces about this movie, I can confess that the first time I saw it, I felt a little bewildered by it. And, you know, this is not really an apt comparison, but it kind of reminded me of like the first time that I saw Gone Girl. I sort of walked out of it feeling like, I don't know how to feel about that. And then I kept going back to it and found so much richness and things to love about it. And so now that I've seen May December three times, I feel like I understand it a little better in some ways, but also understand it less, which is kind of what's interesting about it. Charles Melton, I met him the other night. I was at a New York Tastemaker Academy screening reception for May, December in Manhattan. And there were all kinds of people there. My favorite sighting of the group was Mikhail Baryshnikov, the ballet dancer, AKA the Russian.
He's my generation.
Of course, that was like my favorite sighting of all these people. But I did say this to Charles Melton. I was like, you know, I wasn't sure how to feel about this movie the first time I saw it. And now it's like creeping up on me a little bit. And I think, and I will concede that maybe this is an issue of the movie and that it sort of demands that you see it again and again to sort of peel back the layers of the performance. But I do feel like what he's doing there becomes much more interesting the more you revisit it, because, you know, he really is playing someone who's been groomed his entire life and into his early 30s. And there's a scene later in the movie where he sort of like lays it all bare to Julianne Moore's character about like the particulars of the relationship and how it started. And she's sort of cast the blame on him for quote unquote seducing her or whatever.
He was 12,
which would be impossible. And I think she says, I think her lisp is even employed in this moment. It's like, you seduced me. But I think what he's doing is really interesting there. And I mean, look, we kind of all thought that Robert Downey was going to be the front runner for supporting actor, and he very well may continue to be, right?
Or even Ryan Gosling or Mark Ruffalo. I mean, where's Poor Things? Where is Maestro? I mean, these are movies that are significantly absent from these are buzzy movies that are absent from these votes. And Lily Gladstone won Best Actress in both of these. But I'm going to argue, and Killers of the Flower Moon won Best Picture from the New York Film Critics. I'm going to argue, that it's been many years. I think 2011 is the last time that a movie that was voted Best Picture by Best Film by the New York Film Critics Circle made it to Best Film, you know, Best Picture Oscar. And that was The Artist back then. So they don't match up. They don't always match up at all. I think the only winner from last year that went on to the Oscars was Ke Huy Quan, you know, from Everything Everywhere All at Once. So don't expect these to be predictive, but you can see support growing, you know. So I'm going to argue this. Killers of the Flower Moon and May December are critics' films. They just are. They have had more support from the critics all along. And I believe over time, as we move forward into other groups like the guilds, that they will get less support than the critics have given.
And Killers of the Flower Moon for Best Film and New York Film Critics was such a New York Film Critics kind of choice. I mean, they adore Martin Scorsese. He came last year and he waxed rhapsodic about Tar. You know what I mean? It's like he's a towering presence.
Tar was the big winner at the New York Film Critics last year and didn't get anything
at
the Oscars after six nominations. So that this is just I'm just trying to be, you know, practical here. But Davine Joy Randolph getting supporting actress, that could go all the way to the Oscars.
I think so. I believe in the holdovers, and I believe she is the representative of the holdovers at this point in the race.
Along with the screenwriter, I would say.
Other people are going to be represented, but she seems to be the face of it right now in the awards race. And, you know, speaking of things that are not predictive, but something I was very happy about with the New York Film Critics was Franz Rogowski winning Best Actor for Passages. I just interviewed him yesterday. I'm so glad I did that one, actually, now. And it's funny because I was kind of talking to some on Sunday. I was at a dinner for, of all things, The Taste of Things, which, of course, was the dinner that you have to go to of any dinner of any movie.
I went to one at Telluride that was quite memorable with the chef and everything.
As was this one. And they served a pot au feu and they did all the whole pageantry, you know, reflective of the movie. Look, I'm not like a whisperer among voters, but I did talk to some New York Film Critics people and I said, you should consider Franz Rogowski. Like, that would be a really good one to uphold in your awards. That movie's not getting any Oscar nominations.
No, it's not. And I'm delighted that they did that. They had to declare their independence in some way. So screenplay also May, December, not the strong suit of that movie. I'm sorry, I'm being awful. But I don't know that May, December will do as well with the Oscars. We shall see. Then the documentary went to Menu. Speaking of taste of things, right? I'm going to practice my French accent. Menu plaisir les trois gois.
That's right. That's right. I mean, look, I don't speak that good French that well, but that is correct as far as I know. But I mean, come
on. Frederick Wiseman, it's wonderful. I'm so delighted.
That one I could have predicted the New York Film Critics to award. Like, he's such a New York quintessential filmmaker. That's, you know, they're always going to go for him.
A big, big, big body of work.
And it's 4 hours. So I don't know that that's going to be one that
Academy. How many of them saw the whole thing?
Yeah, no, I know.
They're rewarding it because they did sit through it. So animated film was The Boy and the Heron, also predictable. Miyazaki, very popular, very respected. But you know, that'll go on to be nominated at the Oscars, but the front runner, I'm curious to see what happens at the Oscars there, because I would think that, Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse, the sequel to the other, animated, Spider-Man movie Lord and Miller that won last time. So the question is, do they give a sequel the win again? And sometimes they don't. You know,
no,
as wonderful as it is.
And did they award a movie that was beloved by the public? That was a huge box office success, right? You know, I mean, this is always like a philosophical difference in what, say, the microcosm of the New York Film Critics Award versus the Academy, which, you know, tends to go
the animation in a more mainstream direction. Yeah, right. The animation and shorts branch is smallish. And they're very specific and they have very specific tastes. And then you're allowed to vote if you sign up for it, you know, anybody can vote for animation feature now, but I'm curious to see how that goes. It's a question of whether they consider the animation to be extraordinary and the storytelling. That's what it comes down to.
I mean, and what Boy and the Heron does is amazing, but so same with Spider-Man, you know, and same with something like Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. Like, there are real, like, animated cinematic accomplishments.
So The Boy and the Heron
is
more about the past and the, you know, the extraordinary respect they have for Miyazaki. And then, but the Spider-Verse movie is much more, about the future and how Lord and Miller and their teams have just radically changed and expanded the possibilities for animation. And I would think that would have a lot of supporters. Well, the only other thing I want to bring up in terms of these awards is that the first film went to Past Lives at the New York Film Critics.
Oh, yeah.
Which won the Gothams. So that's a good thing. That's a good thing for that movie that needs support going forward.
And you know, with the New York Film Critics, I understand that they sometimes will give a best first film to a best film, but they tend to try to split those awards. And Past Lives is one I maybe thought they would give the big prize to. You know, actually the other, I don't know if it was unexpected, but it's still kind of an interesting choice for this group was Christopher Nolan for best director for Oppenheimer, which that's another one that does seem like a likely that will repeat at everything.
And they gave cinematography also to Oppenheimer. So Killers of the Flower Moon had two wins. May December had two wins and Oppenheimer had two big wins. Those are big wins.
But I am surprised that there's no, as we mentioned, there's no Poor Things to be found here. No Barbie.
No Barbie.
I can see there maybe wouldn't have been room for Barbie here, but Poor Things is one I thought they would have.
I know, I'm surprised as well. The documentary went to at the Gothams went to Four Daughters, which is an interesting choice. I don't know how far that one's going to get on the other side of on the Oscar equation. And they gave the Breakthrough Director Award at the Gothams went to A.V. Rockwell for 1001, which I love, which is going to be a spirits contender, big spirits contender.
Definitely. I mean, I think that's going to rack up multiple spirit nominations when those get announced on December 5th next week. So it's, you know, it's early.
The Globes nominations too. We're in the thick of it now. The Globes is going to be interesting because the thing about the Globes is that it's let me put it another way. There's the old Golden Globes, Hollywood Foreign Press membership that's still in there, a sort of core group, smaller than it used to be, maybe 50, 60 people. whiter than the rest of the group. And the rest of the group is all over the place, from every country, from across the world. Yeah, very more, much more erudite, more film critic-y. You know, not so much Hollywood foreign press, you know, covering the waterfront. These are more film critics. I'm curious. It's going to be a very different. There's like thousands of them, you know, not less than 100.
No, it's interesting you bring that up. And because there's a movie that we both now can talk about that we've seen that feels like a movie that in the old order of the Golden Globes would be like a big Golden Globes nominee for like best musical, best actor in a musical, which is Wonka.
Well, it still is. I'm sure it still will be. Yeah. I mean, I have to suggest that the block of voters that still is there will have some impact, even if because the others could be spread out around other. I don't know how to explain it. This will be very telling. It'll be a new world to examine how they, because they still break up the categories the way they used to. Barbie is a comedy, you know, so that has to have a lot of advantages in its category.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, are we going to see something like a Jennifer Lawrence for best actress in a comedy No Hard Feelings? Exactly. So, that's very much the kind of thing we would have seen before, you know,
comedy
in a comedy, of course. Yeah.
So that's what's going on there. And also Anatomy of a Fall did well with the Gothams, winning 2 screenplay and international.
And it won international for the New York Film Critics.
Yeah, so that's doing very well. That's a popular movie, Anatomy of a Fall, even with its length.
At IndieWire, we're working on all of our year-end kind of coverage. And so I rewatched that movie. I hadn't seen it since August. And it's really powerful. Like, it really is not just Sandra Hüller's performance, but just on the filmmaking level, it's really spectacular. And that's not one I want to see get forgotten in the mix, even if it's not representing France.
It's not representing France, which means it has to win some. It has to get in other categories. But I wouldn't be surprised if that landed a Best Picture nomination, honestly. Wonka at the Oscars is another matter. I loved it. Okay. I really did. I enjoyed it very much. It's from the Paul King Paddington Bear universe, right? As if it were married to the Roald Dahl universe. And it is, you know, the character Wonka comes from Charlie and the Chocolate Factory that he wrote. So, but it's a whole new story, and it's got the is it Lumpa Lumpa? What is the name of the Wumpa Lumpa? What is it called?
Oompa Loompa.
Oompa Loompa. So that's Hugh Grant. Miniature Hugh Grant, hilarious. And the villain is Olivia Colman. I mean, you can't go wrong. I mean, there's some great stuff in here.
Can you go? I think you can go wrong. With this one, I don't know, Anne. I got to really disagree with you on this one. I felt like, look, maybe the perspective I'm looking at it is from there. I really felt like there was nothing for adults here, at least for an adult such as myself, who purports to be one. I found it to be grotesque and horrible.
I found it light on its feet, delightful, charming.
I thought it was boring as hell, and boring to the point where I couldn't even follow it anymore because I felt like the plot was so inane. The central sort of dilemma with Wonka, and I apologize, I'm not that familiar with the doll text, but sort of his issue is that he's illiterate. And so he's sort of confronting this. And sort of this is one of his motivations. And he's
this
developing a relationship.
What I would put front and center as far as that story
but
goes.
But it stood
it's
out
more about getting his money to make his chocolate. The people, the corporate forces that are arrayed against him.
There is sort of a perverse thing that we, and I'm contributing to this as well, that the news desks in the industry sort of do, is like when the reactions for a movie like this drop, it's like we do this first reactions post where everyone is fawning over it. And sort of, I'm sort of looking at the ones that aggregated all of these on Tuesday. And it's a lot from people who tend, it's sort of these junket groupies that really positive reactions to things. And like, even one of them was like, oh, this movie is a delicious, wonderful confection, but I have serious problems with Poor Things. And I'm sort of like, I don't know if you should be the one out there making these kind of calls.
We probably make too much of a fuss over these first reactions. We know exactly who they are. Maybe we should say who they are. Maybe we should be more, maybe put it in the right context when we write those stories.
Also, in the early interviews about this movie, Paul King said that he cast Timothy Chalamet without an audition at all, which fine, it's Timothy Chalamet, that makes sense. But he said that he sings like Bing Crosby. And I'm like, really?
That's not
like
true.
His singing is sort of more akin to like musical theater karaoke. He's there's nothing against Timothy Chalamet. I adore him and his work, but it's like, can't really sing and he can't really dance.
I don't know that he carries
the movie that well.
It isn't musical theater warbling. He doesn't have a beautiful tenor, but it's a more conversational style of singing, which I actually think works very well in a contemporary movie like this. And I found his singing perfectly pleasant. I enjoyed it. It was absolutely fine.
And it's opening December 22nd. It's going to be a really big family Christmas movie. You know, these are the kind of things that Paul King delivers very well. And so for that, it succeeds on those terms. But I got to say, I don't share in your love for this one.
So what is still to be seen? You have to catch up on a few things, Ryan, right? What are you going to catch up with soon?
I've got to catch up with Origin.
And I still have to do that too.
I got to catch up with The Color Purple. So we're going to do those. But, you know, it's coming along.
And you're seeing American Fiction tonight?
Yes, yes. And I know you're a really big fan of that one. And that's opening in a couple weeks as well. And that's one that a lot of people are predicting to be a big contender in the Best Picture race.
In any of these critics groups. If I were the people at Maestro, I'd be a little unhappy, but I think these films, Poor Things and Maestro, will do very well when the time comes.
No, it's true. And I think Maestro is going to be one that gets a ton of Academy Award nominations, but it is interesting that it's not resonating so much with these groups, though we did get a sort of tribute, albeit one that was, you know, bought to a certain extent. Yeah, exactly. They helped pay for the event, pay for my dinner. it's still a factor in these things, but that is one I thought maybe would figure a little bit more into New York Film Critics, because there is a real passion for that one among that group that I can attest to.
Yeah, no, it's a question of what knocked what out. As far as Maestro in LA, there was a lovely lunch that Netflix threw at the Sunset Tower Hotel with Carrie Mulligan at one end of the table and Matt Bomer at the other. And I got to sit next to Carrie Mulligan, which is very nice. And these things are very interesting. You had a range of people from the trades and the various newspapers and alongside on either side of the table. And it was a conversation that was sometimes about Maestro. Like I learned more about the that kind of improv session, dream session that Bradley Cooper orchestrated, where they all had these. That's where they came up with the idea for sitting back to back, and she came up with the idea for playing the game. Some from her youth. I did not appreciate how much improvisation there was. That Bradley Cooper really encouraged that on the movie. So that was, you know, I like learning these things. That's what's good about these events, you know, to meet Dominic Sessa, the young man who makes his debut in The Holdovers, was to meet somebody very young and possessed and already in college now studying theater at Carnegie Mellon, you know, and I was just delighted by that. You know, I was literally talking to someone who was attending his first promo event like that.
I would love to talk to him then and then see where he's at the end of all of this, right?
Because you don't get to see the virgins very often.
No, you don't. And it's lovely to talk to someone who's not super jaded and not to like go back to Charles Melton again, but just talking to him at that event earlier this week. I mean, he's really only known, I mean, and widely known, really popular from the show Riverdale, but he is totally alien to this whole world. And he's going to have to get used to it because he's going to be at a lot of these now.
Yeah. No, it goes on and on and on. So what else are we watching? You and I both checked out the first couple of episodes of the fifth season of Fargo.
Yes, and because I just desperately needed some counter programming from all this stuff. So now I've been watching Fargo. I'm current on the first three episodes. I actually confess I didn't watch the last season, but I had seen the previous three. You know, there was the Ewan McGregor one, There was another with Kirsten Dunst, and then obviously
I saw that one.
the first one. And this is the Noah Hawley show for Netflix that sort of
and they put new
expands.
people in each season.
That's right. It's like an
Whole new
anthology
cast.
Series, really. How far are you along?
So I got two episodes in. I was astonished by the way they opened it, you know, which only serves to it's sort of like Poor Things in a way. In other words, you're in an alternate universe. You're not entirely in the real world. And they have to establish that right off the bat, so that you open up in the middle of a school board meeting where everybody's attacking each other, and the woman who we're following, who is absolutely terrific, a British actress who I've been a fan of for a long time,
Juno Temple.
Yeah, she was very good, by the way, in the movie that they made about the making of The Godfather. Did you ever see that? It was a series.
The series. No, I didn't watch that one because it was excoriated by critics, and so I avoided it.
I loved it. I actually loved it. And Miles Teller was actually good in it. But anyway, I was fascinated by it. But she was good in that too. She plays American very well. And in this case, she's playing Fargo, Minnesota American, which is hilarious.
Yeah. And what we find out is that this Minnesota persona, this Minnesota nice persona that they introduce, is not quite exactly who she is, and she has ties to, and now that you've seen the first two episodes, you've now seen John Hamm with the nipple rings, which
unbelievable.
Are prosthetic. And it's really, and he is sort of this, it almost seems like he's a cult leader. We don't totally know what's going on with him, but he's
supposedly
connected.
The sheriff.
Right. But there is something shady going on with his connection with the Juno Temple character. And it's really nice to see him. I can already tell just from the two episodes that he's in, it's like, this is going to be one of his best roles since Mad Men.
Oh, he looks fabulous too, by the way.
Yeah.
There's this great scene where he's in a hot tub and he's taking a meeting in the hot tub, and they obviously want to meet with him in person, you know, not in the hot tub. So he stands up and gets out.
and he doesn't have a, and this has always been true of John Hamm. He doesn't have he's got a bit of a dad body. He doesn't have a perfect physique, which is what's sort of appealing about him. You know, he's a little bit pudgy in certain places.
You're coming from a different perspective, Ryan,
I would
suggest to you.
I am coming from
perhaps a more persnickety, young perspective. I will tell you that John Hamm looked fabulous. Absolutely fabulous.
Well, I'm really excited to keep watching that show this season.
Yeah, it's very witty and sharp and unexpected and fun. It takes turns that you don't see coming. So I'm really. And Jennifer Jason Leigh is playing this woman's mother-in-law, and so the two of them are pitted against each other in a fight to the death, and you don't know who's going to win. Really.
Yeah, she's sort of like this, she's this very conservative kind of CEO. She assembles a family picture where she asks that everyone be holding guns. It's always really wonderful to see her around because she's sort of, you know, she's been on the margins in recent years and maybe even since Hateful Eight. But I mean, she has this sort of dry sort of demeanor, this comportment that I just, it's sort of her signature that I always love to spend time with.
It brought me back. I mean, remember that Fargo is, you know, on some level inspired by the Coen brothers movie, and Jennifer Jason Leigh starred in the Hudsucker Proxy.
That's right. That's right.
Many people don't remember.
Yeah. It was one of her early roles. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. We'll get back on the case next week. And next week we have a special guest on the show. We have one of our live interviews that we do every month or so. We have Ryan Johnson and Ron Bergman, the partners at T Street Productions, who made Fair Play and American Fiction. And we've talked to them.
And next week, Anne, you and I will be in the same room doing the podcast together.
He's coming to LA.
Yeah.
Because we've got our big IndieWire Honors event, which will be exciting. We're going to be giving out awards to the likes of Todd Haynes and Greta Gerwig and Lily Gladstone.
And Lily Gladstone.
All right. See you then. Look forward.
Bye.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time. No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.